You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now, if you think Epicureanism is all about indulgence, well, you don't know your ancient philosophy. First, some history. Epicurus was born on a Greek island called Samos. Plato had died a few years before he was born, and Aristotle was still alive and teaching at the Lyceum in Athens. Epicurus would come to be known for his philosophy on pleasure. You may have even seen the spiffy Epicurious website for gourmets. They have a great recipe for deviled eggs when I checked it recently. But Epicurus the philosopher is often misunderstood. He was no one-dimensional hedonist. And our guest is here today to argue that what Epicurus believed remains deeply relevant. We're also going to talk about why understanding the Greek philosophers is a necessary and valuable endeavor. Catherine Wilson is a philosopher. She's a professor at City University of New York, and her new book is titled How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. She's with us from New York. Catherine, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
You spend some time at the beginning of the book talking about what Epicureanism is not. How do we get such a one-dimensional image of what Epicureanism is?
That's a question I've just been thinking about recently. How did it happen that it got, I won't say degraded, because these Epicurean recipes can be really great, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
But how did it happen that a philosophy that was a complete system of nature, that had things to say about religion and politics, as well as ethics and personal life, how did it get narrowed down into that foodie philosophy? And I think what happened was that the scientific parts, the religion critique parts, kind of got hived off into separate lines of development. And the ethics, too, got absorbed into kind of mainstream utilitarian thinking about ethics. And so what we were left with as Epicureanism, when all that was taken away, was kind of the food and pleasure aspect, even though that's, in a way, a small part of the actual teaching of Epicurus.
So you're saying there was a kind of picking and choosing of this wider philosophy that was pulled into other philosophies, other ideas about the way to live, and then just the essence of this idea of it's all about pleasure was left?
Well, I don't think it was deliberate. I think what happened was that the cosmology and the theory of matter and laws of nature were just taken up by the sciences beginning in the 17th century. And the same thing really happened with the politics and the ethics in the 18th century. So people were drawing on the Epicurean tradition, but developing it in these updated ways.
Got it. You know, the other thing I wondered about is whether Epicurus was overshadowed by some of the household names of philosophy. Plato, Aristotle, Diogenes, who founded the Cynic philosophy, because, I mean, you make a point of saying Epicureanism is not the intellectual equivalent of comfort food, that there is a real and a rigorous philosophy at the center of this. I guess I wonder if the other big stars of philosophy just overshadowed him.
Yeah, that's absolutely what happened. And one reason it happened was that Platonism and Aristotelianism could be fitted much better into Christianity, into Christian philosophical thinking. And as we know, of course, that was not only dominant religion, but a dominant cultural force right down to at least the 18th century. And so what happened was that Epicurus and even the Stoics were much easier to reconcile with Christianity. The Epicureans were really outsiders because they did
not that makes sense, right?
They did not believe in a God who had created the universe or who took special care of human beings or even paid any attention to events on Earth. And they taught that death was the end, there was no afterlife. And that pleasure was the thing to that gave your life value. And of course, this was anathema to traditional Christian thinking.
You know, as I
even though there were some Christian Epicureans,
tell me,
I think Erasmus is sometimes thought of as a Christian Epicurean who thought that they could be reconciled, but you have to ignore a lot in order to effect that.
I guess I was. As I got deeper into your book and was starting to understand what this philosophy stood for, I thought of it as pleasure with a purpose. And you really can't understand the philosophy if you don't understand the purpose side of that. Now, is that too distilled, too simple?
What were you thinking of in terms of purpose?
Well,
that will help.
There is a reason for the Epicurus gives us a reason for the pursuit of these different pleasures within this overall system. It is not pleasure for the sake of pleasure, or is it?
Well, yeah, I think that may be a little more end directed than
okay.
the Epicureans really were.
Okay.
So I think rather than pursuit of pleasure, what they're saying is you have permission. You have permission to enjoy things, even though so many ethical traditions tell you that pleasure is the enemy.
Right.
Oh, all the great philosophers say pleasure is opposed to morality. Morality involves self-sacrifice and a form of asceticism. Freud pointed that out, that we think of ascetic people as very holy, as very in touch with spiritual forces. And we think of people who enjoy things as rather animalistic and piggish. At least they tend to get portrayed that way in the polemical literature. So I think Epicureans wouldn't say there's a purpose to individual life. But there's a sort of fitting in to wider nature that can substitute for religion and that can make you feel that life isn't just pointless and that humanity isn't just a pointless species that's anyway going to die out in another few hundred thousand years.
Don't you feel that we are still having this debate or this push and pull between this idea of what you just said about this perception that ascetics are the holy, the people that we should aspire to, and this idea of being pleasure-seeking is piggish. I can see that in a lot of the kind of cultural debates that we're having today. What do you observe about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there do seem to be people who just want to drink, carouse, spend money, drive large, expensive, fast cars, and we think that kind of life is meaningless, purposeless. And here I think the Epicurean idea of limits has a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
There's a limit to how much pleasure you can actually get. And that limit is actually set fairly low in some ways. You don't need to spend a lot of money. You don't need to wreck your health. You don't need to hurt other people in order to have a pleasant life. If you just think about the resources that you have to gratify all your senses and to be active in the world, I put a lot of stress not only on getting out into nature, but also on friendship, doing things with other people, and also on making things, doing things with your hands, doing things with your whole body, dance, exercise, things like that.
We did a show, I don't know, months ago now, but some of what our listeners had to say about it has stuck with me. It was about whether you are better to spend your money on acquiring things or better to spend your money on experiences. And there's some really intriguing social science on this. And we had quite a lively debate with callers calling in to say the kind of pleasure that they get from spending money might be on buying one of those large cars you just talked about or on having a unique experience. I really did wonder where Epicurus would come down on this as I thought about that show.
That's right. Well, he certainly wasn't into acquiring material objects. But I think the problem with that dichotomy is that for many people, and I am guilty of this too, buying things is an experience, a very pleasurable experience. You go into a department store and there are all these things on display. And if you don't watch it, every single thing is something that you could use or that you think would make your life better. But then you look at your overstuffed closet and your overstuffed drawers and you think, do I really need all this? Am I really getting any benefit from it? So I think the Epicurean puts a lot of emphasis on choosing and avoiding and really reflecting every time you've bought something and used it or had it on display, thinking about, did I really get the pleasure from this that I thought I was going to get when I acquired it? And if not, then you become more judicious about the next shopping trip you make. Another tip for people like me, and as my son has pointed out, I cannot pass a window full of colorful or glittery objects without stopping in front of it. I'm sure I'll get some sympathy there from your listeners.
And from me, yeah.
But one thing to do is to think, I like this. It's pretty. Maybe it's even beautiful. But I don't need to have it. Mm. I can just appreciate its beauty the way I would something in a museum. And then, you know, if you're really obsessed by it, if your mind keeps returning and returning to it, then maybe that thing really will give you pleasure.
That because one of the things that came up in that show and that you're reminding me of is really being in touch with the experience of novelty. Do I want it? And you've just described this. Do I want it because it's new and glittery? How soon is the pleasure of acquiring it going to wear off? Because that's what makes a closet full of glittery, nice things, right? The pleasure of it has worn off.
That's right. But there are always some things that we're so happy that we have. Just every time we look at them, we think, that was a really great purchase. But they're few. They're a small percentage of the things that we actually own.
Catherine Wilson is with us this morning. She's a philosophy professor, and she's the author of How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. I'd like to ask you, as you listen to this conversation develop, about how you think about pleasure. Less is more, novelty, experience, acquisition. Do you have a personal philosophy that guides you in the way that you access pleasure? 651-227-6000. Yeah, even as I said that, I thought, we're going to get some really unusual calls here. 800-242-2828. And to the phones here to Carly in Chanhassen. Hi, Carly. Glad you called.
Hi.
Hi. What'd you want to add to this?
I wanted to bring up that the mindset behind this really reminds me of that thing that was going around lately with the Marie Kondo and Swedish desk cleaning. They're trying to get rid of a bunch of garbage from your house and stuff that you don't think that you need.
What in the heck is Swedish death cleaning? I know who Marie Kondo is, but what's that?
Excuse me?
What is Swedish death cleaning?
I heard about it slightly after Marie Kondo came out, and it's where you try to get rid of a lot of the stuff that your children might have to go through when you die.
Huh.
So that it's easier.
I love this question, Carly. Catherine, is there something to this?
Absolutely. The less is more philosophy that we're seeing now. And I think what's happened is that so many things just became so inexpensive. Inexpensive clothes, not inexpensive food. Food seems to be getting more and more expensive. But consumer goods became so plentiful because of free trade, I suppose, that, you know, we just could not resist the impulse to go out and accumulate more and more and more things that we don't use and don't have room for. So these are really wonderful exercises of organizing your life, getting rid of superfluous things that you don't need, and also thinking about the next generation that, oh, in my case, don't want to deal with a bunch of costume jewelry and scarves and,
and glittery things
in drawers. Right?
I'll take your glittery things, Catherine. Don't worry. The other thing about that, this trend with Marie Kondo is you do become more, I think, I don't want to say restrictive, but more deliberate, right? In the next things that you're acquiring. So it's not only about clearing out, but it's also shaping your idea of what else you're bringing into your life. And I've seen people make serious changes, you know, in this philosophy.
Yes, it's about mindfulness.
Yes, mindfulness.
Every
exactly.
time you're acquiring something. And there's a wider context to this. We really have to do this for global ecological reasons. And I think there's a real conflict brewing between the people who think that growth is good and growth ultimately involves taking raw materials, turning them into consumer products, selling them to somebody, and then burying them in giant trash heaps or dumping them in the ocean. That's what growth is. And that's what many mainstream economists think we have to keep doing. And when we've exhausted this planet, we can go live on Mars. But I think the Epicurean perspective is, look, there are limits to growth. We can't go on living the way we do, and we can't globally hope that every other nation on Earth is going to come up to the typical U.S. standard of living. It's just not sustainable. So there are good reasons beyond personal tranquility and equilibrium for thinking about this political system and our contribution to it, this economic and political system.
Call here from Shal in Minneapolis. Hey, Shal, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing
Thank
well.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, glad you called.
I have a real quick question. This is really about your guest conversations about, drawing pleasure from experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, these are two that sort of dovetail with each other, Physical activity, so in my case, underwater hockey, followed by binging at Taco Bell. Right?
Yeah. So what's your question about that?
So it's really about we sort of get brainwashed into buying stuff and correlating our happiness to that. And you don't need to, right?
Yeah.
You can get away from it. So it's more of a comment than a question. So you can do away from the notion of trying to buy something and force yourself to do something different, which, it could be physical activity, it could be a walk in the park, whatever. You don't need to buy to be happy.
Could Epicurus have admired a simple life of underwater hockey and Taco Bell, Catherine, do you think?
I think Epicurus would have an issue. Underwater hockey would be great. But Taco Bell, I think Epicurus would raise some questions about that. First, does that food actually taste good compared to what you could make yourself with some fresh ingredients in about 15 minutes. I know, because I like to make really fast things like that at home. But the other issue is prudence. Maybe your diet is fantastic the rest of the time, but if that's mostly what you eat, you're going to harm your health. And for an Epicurean, you want to think not only about immediate pleasure, but about long-term consequences. How are you going to feel after 30, 40 years of eating a non-optimal diet that doesn't include a lot of fresh things and doesn't have preservatives and chemicals and so forth?
Dan says on Twitter, having just returned from a week in the Caribbean sun, my idea of pleasure is experience, especially physical experience, which can also liberate the soul. Sometimes vigorous exercise, sometimes just the feeling of sun on skin makes me feel especially human and alive. Mike called from New Hope. He says, the first time I encountered Epicurus, I was in the Navy and a fellow officer exposed me to the philosophy. The thing I remember most ironically is the food that he liked and I believe prescribed. It was all white and bland, like rice and pears. Very bland, not that enjoyable. Epicurus was no glutton, you tell us in the book.
That's right. He said he just lived on a little bread, cheese, and water. It's fine. I suspect, as I mentioned in the book, that they had somewhat more varied diet because that one, I don't think you'd be getting enough of your vitamin C or many other things that you need. And it's monotonous. You really can't just eat bread and cheese every day. And there are many other excellent things to eat. But it's interesting that you mentioned this person in the Navy, I think, because military people have typically been drawn to Stoicism over Epicureanism. And I think there are reasons for that. The Epicureans were very anti-war. They did not think you would have a very happy life if you joined the army. And they didn't think that you should get into situations where you have to have a Stoic attitude about pain. Pain is something to be avoided, by avoiding situations in which you have a very high probability of suffering. And I think it's important to talk about this because many people in our country are really suffering a lot for various reasons, health reasons, stress, difficulties at work, difficulties in their relationships. And here the Epicureans had something to say as well. It's not all about pursuing pleasure. It's about avoiding pain.
And what would you say was the core philosophy about that?
Well, I think where the Stoic says pain and obstacles and difficulties are inevitable and you've just got to tough it out and try to detach yourself and not get emotional about things, many people find that helpful. But the Epicurean says it's better to avoid those situations in the first place. Hmm. That's prudence. That's thinking ahead. And that means limit your ambitions, limit your acquisitive, put limits on your acquisitive nature, as we were talking about, but also seek help for your physical and mental pain. Friendship is really important to them because good friends can take a lot of the burden and a lot of the stress off daily living.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to do these things alone. Stoics are very big on you can master this by yourself. Just fix yourself up. And,
up by the bootstraps kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Just endure. You are an inner citadel, they say. The outside world cannot affect you. Where the Epicureans see you as much more permeable. Your emotions are part of you. The emotions are not bad. The emotions are what make life worth living. They're what motivate us, what enable us to make decisions. But think ahead. Think about the consequences. Think about what usually happens. And, of course, relief of pain is really central to Epicurean philosophy. We wouldn't have this opioid epidemic in this country if so many people weren't in physical and mental pain.
Epicurus, speaking of physical pain, had kidney stones in his later years and died. Did he die of them at 72?
Yes. I'm not exactly sure how kidney stones kill you as opposed to just being, terribly painful. But he did die.
You say that present-day Epicureans have respect for mortality, even as they regard it as needing adjustment to current circumstances. What was their view on living a life that pushed mortality out further, but then on the idea of acceptance if you were, if you had a life-threatening kind of condition like he did?
Right. They did not favor suicide as the Stoics did.
Mm-hmm.
Epicurus says, even blindness, which is terrible, is something that you can come to terms with. And that's something that psychologists have seemed to have borne out, that even people who have to use a wheelchair and feel terrible about it at the start, after a year, their levels of satisfaction have more or less returned to what they were beforehand. Epicureans, again, this idea of limits comes into play. There's a kind of best before date for all of us. Some very bold physicians claim this age is 75. You might want to put it somewhat farther out. But inevitably, we are going to deteriorate. We're going to develop aches and pains, and then we're all going to die. And it's very hard to believe this in your own case. And many people don't make the preparations that we were talking about in connection with clearing out your closets and making things easy for your children. And many people are so into life extension. They think that by taking these supplements or getting some kind of fancy procedure of transfusing their blood out and other blood in or something,
right,
they're going to live to 120. But if you really think about the consequences of living to 120, you're probably going to have 40 years of some form of disability. Your friends will mostly be dead unless they did the same thing. Maybe your children will die before you, which seems to me a really horrible thought. So acceptance of mortality, not engaging in futile end-of-life procedures. Doctors will do everything unless they are specifically requested not to, because that's their job. So there's beginning to be a trend of refusing end-of-life treatment. Some physicians even refuse screening and all sorts of tests when they get into their late 60s, early 70s, on the ground that there is just no point to it.
Yeah, I think Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel got a lot of heat when he wrote something a few years ago about 75, being
yes,
that
in
point
the Atlantic,
in your life,
wasn't
right?
It?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not. I think it was misunderstood as you should just kill yourself if you're above 75. It was more, as you've said, you have reached kind of your, this is often when the disability begins, right? And the difficulties and the health problems after 75. You should be very aware of the decisions you're making about that age. I don't know whether the message really permeated the outrage that followed that, but it's a good discussion, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to take one last call for you, Catherine, from Mary
okay.
in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary. Thank you so much for waiting. Tell me about this. Hey, Mary, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, tell me about what you're doing as you listen to the show.
Oh, I'm in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I'm sitting in a park, a local park here, and watching the Mississippi River roll by and the leaves fall from the trees. And my point was just that you can take an hour. You don't have to go to Caribbean to take a break. And I wondered what the author thought about. Really, it seems like I think I have Epicurean values because I'm anti-war and I love bread and cheese, but I also think it's about meaning. And Viktor Frankl wrote Man's Search for Meaning and talked about logotherapy and what's really important. You know, he was in the concentration camps and had to find meaning when nothing was left in his world. And I worked as a therapist, a psychotherapist, and I think many times people are trying to find happiness through things or that there's some magic cure. And I think it comes back to making meaning in your life.
Mary, I love the idea of you listening to the show on a morning where you're soaking in the sunshine. Thanks for the call. Catherine, thank you for the conversation.
You're very welcome.
Catherine Wilson's book is called How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.